Yesterday, we spoke about Lord Ramachandra. Today, we're going to speak about Lord Kapila. Are you a little new also? You are? Okay. I'm going to focus in on YouTube a little bit, just to make sure we're not at 30%, we're closer to 50% of receiving. Yesterday, when we spoke about Lord Ramachandra, I mentioned that he's one of the Leela avatars, remember? You know the Sanskrit word avatar?
I do.
You do? Okay, so you're not that new. Besides the movie, you know, the forms of the Lord that descend in this world. So that means they exist in the spiritual world, they're eternal. Have their own abode, their own residence, planet, place in the spiritual world. And from time to time, they come to this world. That's avatar. For a purpose. And those... This is a little education item, so listen carefully. There's different categories. Six. Six different types of avatars. So the type or the category from last night is Leela avatar. Ramachandra, Buddha, Kalki comes at the end of this age and annihilates everybody and starts the next age. Liberates everybody and starts the next age. Nrisingadev, Leela avatar. Vamana, the dwarf form of the Lord. Leela avatar. There's 10 principal, but there's many, many Leela avatars. So that's one category. So rather than going through the list of six, we're going to be discussing Kapila Dev, who is in a different, actually he's in two different categories. Shakti, you've heard that term. Shakti, potency, power. Shakti Avesh. Avesh means one who is receiving power. A living entity, you're a living entity? Okay. It's possible for a living entity to be bearing or carrying the entire full potency of the Supreme to carry out a particular function. So that's called the Shakti Avesh. Some examples, familiar examples. Narada Muni. Narada Muni is bearing the Lord's Bhakti Shakti. Narada Muni. The four Kumaras, they're bearing the Lord's Jnana, or knowledge potency. Like that, so... They're living entities, but the fullness, and that's a lot, the fullness of the Lord's potency of a particular type of function or potency that carries out the function, they're exhibiting that. They received it, they're carrying it, they're exhibiting it. Another example is Prithu, fourth canto, Srimad Bhagavatam. He bears the Lord's ruling potency, Palana Shakti, Lord Brahma, creative potency, Srishti Shakti. So that's a category. Shakti Vesha Avatar. Kapila Dev is a living entity who is bearing the Lord's potency to carry out a specific function, and that function is in a third category, Yuga Avatar. Yuga means age. Yes? You familiar with that term, Yuga? Okay. So, he is the Yuga Avatar for the first of the four ages, Satya Yuga. And that process for the first of the four ages of Satya Yuga is meditation. Dhyayate. Meditation. So he teaches meditation upon the Supreme Lord. And what's the purpose of the meditation upon the Supreme Lord? It leads into, or it's part of and leads into devotional service. Just like Prahlad Maharaj. I'm going slowly because I don't know if you're familiar with the names. Prahlad, he was son of Hiranyakashipu, and he was protected by Lord Nrisingadeva. That's Prahlad. So Prahlad achieved perfection just by remembrance of the personality of Godhead. And it's not to understand. That's all he did. He just sat in his room, or in a cave, or on a mountaintop, and he just remembered the Supreme Lord. He did all kinds of things. And while he did all kinds of things, his mind was fixed upon the Supreme Lord. And in that way, he exhibited perfection. Good times, bad times. For him, there was no duality, because he was absorbed in thought of the Lord. And the Lord always protected him. And he always felt protected. He didn't worry for himself. Oh, what if? He was absorbed in thought of the Lord. So Kapiladeva is also teaching being absorbed in thought of the Lord. The form is very specific. But the pervasive foundation and substructure of all of Kapiladeva's teachings is bhakti. And what Prabhupada writes in this section is, for this process of meditation in Satya Yuga and the process of meditation upon the holy name in Kali Yuga, there are corollary or there are matching forms or manifestations of that, but that, you know, the essence is the same, pure devotional service. It's important because it can be confusing. And so it's nice to be unconfused rather than confused. Kapiladeva isn't teaching something other than devotional service as he's teaching devotion. Excuse me, as he's teaching meditation. And prior to teaching meditation, he taught this whole section on Sankhya Yoga. Sankhya Yoga, you'll find, read in your Bhagavad Gita, chapter 2, text 39, and you'll find that word Sankhya. Krishna says, thus far I've taught Sankhya Yoga. Now I'm going to teach Bodhi Yoga. It's like, he's like, it's da-da-da-da. You know, it's really not unclear. It's very clear. That section of Bhagavad Gita where Krishna is describing the distinction between matter and spirit, and we're in the category of spirit. That's a Sankhya section of Bhagavad Gita. Kapiladeva has, you know, robust multiple chapters on Sankhya system, just a more detailed elaboration on the same thing. There's so much to be said about that. But so Kapiladeva, if you have a quiz question on a written exam sometime and somebody says, write something, what is Kapiladeva most known for? A suitable answer is, he's most known for teaching Sankhya Yoga. When you read Prabhupada's books, Kapiladeva, the propounder of Sankhya Yoga, or the Sankhya system. That's discerning or analyzing the difference between categories of matter and categories of spirit. And then we belong to the category of spirit, not matter. And through false ego, we're thinking matter. I'm this body. But we're not this body. We're spirit. As long as we think that we're matter, then all kinds of things happen, like fruitive activities I want to enjoy. So I do things with me, this body, to get stuff. And then I'm going to find happiness through fruitive activities. It's material life. Has as its foundation a misconception of self. And so Sankhya challenges that misconception and restores the spiritual conception. It's intellectual. It's inadequate. Standing on its own, it's inadequate. It's not all that he taught. So at the end of the Sankhya section, Kapiladeva says, now that we understand, one who understands his position in relation to spirit should fix his mind upon the Supreme Spirit. And so, two chapters of, you know, how to live your life in that way, that's chapters 26, 27. We're going to be reading from chapter 28. And the beginning of 28 is the meditation process itself, which is in a summary way, in a mini summary way, is chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita. I mean, there's a parallel between Krishna's teachings and Kapila's teachings. And chapter 6, Dhyan Yoga, Dhyan is meditation. So in chapter 28, the beginning part, it's detailing, super comprehensively, but far more than chapter 6, Bhagavad Gita, it's detailing the process of Ashtanga Yoga. In fact, in his commentary, Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur says, the first verses 2 through 6, something like that, it's the first two, Yama and Niyama, you know, the do's and the don'ts. I travel so much, I can recite practically the, you know, the announcement they have to make when, you know, the Federal Aviation Authority mandates you must say certain things before the plane leaves. And it's all, you know, little variety between different airlines, but it's basically the same thing. And at the end, Southwest, they say, so that's it, folks, for the do's and the don'ts. The yamas and the niyamas, the do's and the don'ts. And the do's are character related, and the do nots are behavior related. They do the same thing in martial arts a proper teacher, before they teach martial arts. It's, you know, so that they're going to give something powerful to the student, so they want to make sure the student has character. So, you know, the principle of nonviolence is a character principle. The principle of truthfulness, the principle of compassion. I went to an ear doctor. The man was Chinese. You know, well-reputed. Larry... what was his name? Something. And... you know, he has awards and awards and awards. He's a very, you know, renowned guy. So I'm sitting there in my dhoti in his office, and he looks at me and says, well, are you a monk? And, you know, that was the lead-in question general people ask. And then I said, yeah, how long have you been doing that? He said, you know, 44 years. I said, oh, I haven't been practicing my profession for that long. And then with the discussion, it was an affable man, you know, a little reserved, but affable. And he said, you know, what kind of training do you require to do what you're doing? And I said, boot camp. I said, you know, it's basic training, because that's, boot camp is a military term, and basic training is formally what they call it. I said, you know, building of character and regulation, and, you know, some of the basic practices and some of the basic teachings and things like that. before, you know, one gets an occupation, you know, a particular service. Generally, it's, you know, well, it didn't go much beyond that. So building of character is the most important part of education. Here's a Prabhupada story. Prabhupada said he was, when he was a householder in the pharmaceutical business, there was a man that was a very accomplished colleague, and he was interviewing some people for a post in his company. And Prabhupada was there for two of the interviewees, and one had like the super resume, I guess you call it CV now. And he came in, and he didn't close the door, and the man had told him he had to close the door. So then the other one, his resume was like not as nearly as strong, but he closed the door. And the man chose the one with the lesser CV, but the one he closed the door. And Prabhupada asked him why, and he said, because this is a man of character. I can train a man of character. A man that already thinks he knows so much but doesn't have good character, he'll be very difficult to work with. That's in the corporate world. And now Prabhupada's statements, as far as education, our Gurukul's main service, you can take it, you know, the parents of children's main service, or those that are training other devotees' main service, is formation of character. The most important thing. Then on top of character, you can put so many things. It's why, like in Mahabharata, you know, the skill of Arjuna was superlative because his devotion was superlative. And conversely, Duryodhana, Maharaj Yudhisthira, there are five Pandava brothers, Arjuna, his elder brother is Yudhisthira. So he became the king, and he was supposed to become the king because he was the eldest brother. So Yudhisthira, I forgot the example I was going to give. Huh? Yeah, but oh, Krishna, I can't remember. Went away. Huh?
If one has character, you can train him.
Yeah. Anyway, it was an example from Mahabharata that was to show that message. If one has character, you can train him. And I can't remember. So, back to, I'm sorry, I lost my train of thought. Back to Lord Kapiladev. So, the beginning of this chapter 28, it's Yama and Niyama. You know, so the Niyamas, the do nots, are, you know, don't lie, don't steal, and, you know, what the Bible is filled with. You know, the Ten Commandments. Don't do this and don't do that and don't do that. Those are Niyamas. Yeah, so that's the first two. And then what the next one is, they're described in the verses of Kapila. You know, the Ashtanga Yoga system, the third one is asanas. You know, with people when they sign up for a yoga class, they just learn that one. They don't learn the first two. They just learn asanas, generally. And let's just go back to the character item for a moment. One of the core character traits that's important for being trained and receiving that which a teacher or guru has to offer to give is humility. According to Bhagavad Gita, chapter 13, text 8 through 12, humility and pridelessness are first on the list. And there's this common saying, even outside of Vedic wisdom, that humility is the foundation of knowledge. You flip it around. One who is where humility is absent, they may know stuff. So, but that's not what real knowledge is. You're a walking dictionary or an encyclopedia, or you know so many things. A PhD that has bad character is a dangerous guy. Yeah, that was the Yudhisthira saw, now here's the reference, he saw that Duryodhana, he was good. He was ruling the kingdom. He had all the skills of ruling the kingdom. So why should I, let him rule the kingdom? He's doing a good job. But he didn't have character. And that's why Krishna wanted him removed. He not only didn't have character, he had bad character. He was a diabolical guy that had skills. So Krishna wanted Yudhisthira to rule because he had character. Upon the character, he had skills. So Duryodhana was removed. Not voluntarily, but he was removed. So then it just goes through the meditation process, the asanas, and it gives description what the purpose of, doesn't give like a chart of the different asanas, like in a yoga class. It gives the purpose behind it. This is principle-based. And controlling of the body helps balance the body. And, one of the reasons why people take yoga class, you feel good. Mind. It helped bring the mind into balance. And then the next one, breath control, pranayama. And that helps control the life airs. So people do that because they want health, because when the life airs are imbalanced, you have ill health. When the life airs are balanced, you have health. And then that supports concentration. Because the mind is influenced positively or negatively by the airs within the body, oddly enough. Because the mind is subtle, but even something subtle can be, it works both ways. Subtle can influence gross, and gross can influence subtle. Mechanistic science doesn't even talk about that. They discount it. There's no such thing as a mind. Anyway, won't go to that. One affects the other, vice versa. And then pratyahara. You know what pratyahara means? Withdraw of the senses. But it doesn't mean like your arms go inside your body, your legs go inside your body like you look like a pumpkin. That's not what it means. It's the subtle senses. What's the subtle senses? It's the power of seeing. The power of locomotion, the power of hearing, and so forth, the sense of touch, those become consolidated and brought, withdrawn and brought within. Those of you that are familiar with Canto 1, Chapter 9, with Bhishma Dev, when he does that, he withdraws his senses. He does this at will, boom. He can, such a qualified person as Bhishma Dev, at will, they can extend their senses and do service, like the Bhagavad Gita example of the tortoise that can extend his limbs or withdraw his limbs. And he has a nice protective shell. No one can do anything. He's got this protective shell. So a qualified yogi like Bhishma Dev and others, through the pratyahara process, extending the senses is necessary for activity. A bhakti yogi will do that when there's some service. And at will, you know, we don't do the, we don't follow the mechanical process, but we follow, if there's a parallel process, and that the parallel process in bhakti is bhakti. If there's some service for Krishna, there go the senses. And, you know, the power of seeing, the power of speaking, the power of the senses. And if there isn't, they're withdrawn. Anukulyasha sankalpa, pratikulyasha varjanam. Those are familiar with the process of surrender. Accept everything favorable for devotional service, reject everything unfavorable for devotional service. It's pratyahara. Extend your senses, withdraw your senses. If it's in relation to Krishna's service, I'm ready. If it's not in relation to Krishna's service, no, thank you. That's, you know, then that's possible if the intelligence is operating and the mind is complying or obeying the indications of the intelligence. So that's the boot camp. That's the basic training. Learning how to flip it, because material life is the other way around. The mind dictates. And the mind dictates based on what the senses dictate. And the mind says, my dear intelligence, yes, yes, I've got some service for you. What? There's that. See that object of that senses? I want one of those. Can you figure out a way to get one of those for me? Yeah, sure. I may have to go to school for a few years, but I'll figure it out. And I'll report back really soon. Yes, sir. So the senses are ruling the mind, and the mind is ruling the intelligence. It's upside down. Interesting yoga posture, but it should be the other way around. Intelligence directs the mind, and the mind directs the senses. The senses extend, the senses are withdrawn. At pratyahara. And then the next three stages all are specific. All the functions are in relation to the mind. In fact, I'll say two things. Vishwanath Chakrabarti Thakur says all of this is for the purpose of fixing the mind on the Supreme Lord. All eight of them. And then he also says this process of Ashtanga Yoga is Ashtanga mixed with Bhakti. The goal of Ashtanga Yoga, of fixing the mind on the Supreme Lord, is to be situated in loving devotional service to the Supreme Lord. It's not a separate process. It sounds like a separate process. It's stuff we don't do. We don't, you know, sit and press our nose and, you know, do that, the pranayama thing. And, you know, the all that. Sit in a deer skin in a quiet place and in a mountain in a cave somewhere. And we don't do that. The form is different, but the essence is the same, is the point. And you step back from the details, and what you have is, according to Vishwanath Chakrabarti, Sankhya mixed with Bhakti, that then leads to Sankhya plus Ashtanga mixed with Bhakti, which leads to pure Bhakti. The goal is pure Bhakti. Same goal. The means of achieving that is different than this age, which is congregational chanting. Same things are accomplished if one does it properly. Small thing, doing things properly. You know, chanting with full attention. Really. So. There's about 15, 16 verses in a row that just precede what I'm going to be reading from this morning. Which describe how the mind, you know, how do you meditate? If you're in Satya Yuga and you're a follower of Kapila Dev, how do you meditate upon the Supreme Lord while you're doing your asanas? How do you do it? He gives detailed descriptions of the contemplation of the mind. on the form of the Lord. But as the sequence moves through those 15, 16 verses, it becomes not just limbs of the body and ornaments of the body and features of the Lord's form, but then it becomes more and more personal. The form is not different than the person, but it becomes very, very personal, you'll see. Reading text 32, chapter 28. Canto 3. Kapila Dev is speaking to his mother, Devahuti. A yogi should similarly meditate on the most benevolent smile of Lord Srihari, a smile which, for all those who bow to him, dries away the ocean of tears caused by intense grief. The yogi should meditate on the Lord's arched eyebrows, which are manifested by his internal potency, in order to charm the sex god for the good of the sages. Meditating on the eyebrows of the Lord relieves one of mundane sex desire. Text 33. With devotion, steeped with love. Now we're moving into the devotional aspect of the meditation, not just the mechanical aspect of the meditation. The yogi should meditate upon, or within the core of his heart, upon the laughter of Lord Vishnu, not just his form. Now he's laughing. He's happy. So happy he's laughing. This laughter of Vishnu is so captivating that it can be easily meditated upon. When the Supreme Lord is laughing, one can see his small teeth, which resemble jasmine buds rendered rosy by the splendor of his lips. Once devoting his mind to this, the yogi should no longer desire to see anything else. It's a trick. It's to get you free from meditating on anything else. And it works. Text 34. By following this course, the yogi gradually develops pure love. See, there's the goal. Unmixed bhakti. Pure love for the Supreme Personality of Godhead. In the course of his progress in devotional service, the hairs on his body stand erect through excessive joy, and he is constantly bathed in a stream of tears occasioned by intense love. Gradually, even the mind, which he used as a means to attract the Lord, as one attracts a fish to a hook, withdraws from material activity. Text 35. When the mind is thus completely freed from all material contamination and detached from material objectives, it is just like the flame of a lamp. At that time, the mind is actually dovetailed with that of the Supreme Lord and is experienced as one with him. Wait a minute. Is this impersonal conception? It is freed from the interactive flow of material qualities, one with him in the qualitative sense, not in the he becomes, the yogi becomes God. Prabhupada writes in the purport, Yatarchi is this metaphor. Archi means flame. when a, listen to this, it's beautiful. When a lamp is broken or the oil is finished, we see that the flame of the lamp goes out. Yes? But according to scientific understanding, the flame is not extinguished, it is conserved. This is conservation of energy. What upstanding believer in science is going to refute the conservation of energy? Nobody. Because scientists said it. Matter is neither created nor destroyed. Conservation of energy. It just may go to a different state, but it's conserved. Similarly, when the mind stops functioning on the material platform, it is conserved in the activities of the Supreme Lord. Pretty cool, huh? So, the Bhagavad Gita metaphor of the lamp is, you know, the lamp where there's wind and the lamp where there's no wind. Lamp when there's wind, it's very flickering. The flame is moving, we've seen. And if you can get a windless place and there's a flame, it's steady. So, question. You want to be peaceful. Is it possible to be peaceful if your mind is not steady? No. How to make the mind steady? Stop the wind. But how do you stop the wind? Because the wind doesn't stop. You know, the modes of nature are comparable to the influence upon the mind. The mind becomes unsteady by the influence of the modes of nature. So what to do? I'm trying to chant and my mind is all over the place. There's the modes of nature. If we invoke the mercy of Krishna by our sincere endeavor to please him, like Mother Jasoda was trying to bind Krishna and couldn't and couldn't and couldn't, and finally she was able to bind Krishna. How is it she was able to bind Krishna? Krishna exhibited his mercy potency, and then she could bind Krishna. Similarly, if we want to chant, we have to show Krishna we want him in service, not, you know, the other thing, accomplishment, the doership. I'm going to control my mind and capture Krishna. No way. No way. No way. So, Kripa Shakti. Vishwanath Chakravarti Thakur describes that part of the Damodar Leela, that Mother Jasoda was unable to bind Krishna because he was exhibiting two other potencies, his Swarup Shakti and his Icha Shakti. And who can overcome Krishna's Swarup Shakti and his Icha Shakti? Icha means desire. Krishna wanted to go back to the storeroom and eat butter and give to the monkeys. That was his Icha, his desire. So Mother Jasoda can't bind him if Krishna is exhibiting his Icha Shakti. And his Swarup means his own. Sva, Rup, his own personal energy. No way. However much you may try, or Mother Jasoda may try, or 10 Mother Jasodas may try, it's not going to happen. But because of her love, Krishna withdrew those two potencies and exhibited his Kripa Shakti, she was able to bind Krishna. Very important lesson in our lives as devotees. Very important lesson. Commonly we can say Krishna is controlled by love. He who isn't controlled by anybody, he's the supreme controller, he's controlled. It's a mystery. He who is the supreme controller is controlled by the love of his devotee. But then it's a different kind of control. It's love. When we can be controlled by love, and Krishna can be controlled by love. And that's the spiritual world. And that's where happiness is. The other kind of, I'm going to control, or I don't want them to control me, and all of that garbage, that's material existence. the strength of our relationship with Krishna and brings us into the spiritual world. And one can control the mind by the Lord's Kripa Shakti. One can, and when the mind is controlled, fixed upon Krishna, it's fantastic. According to the earlier teachings, rather than go back and read it, but it's expressed so beautifully. When the mind becomes fixed upon the Supreme, the action of the modes of nature stop. And when the action of the modes, they're still like doing their thing, but the impact of them upon the soul no longer influences them. Like the Bhagavad Gita example is the lotus that's above the surface of the water. There can be a storm, but the lotus doesn't get wet because it's above the water. The stem may move like this and that because it's a storm, but the lotus doesn't get wet. So similarly, if the mind, like Prahlad, by being fixed in his mind upon the Supreme Lord, nothing could disturb him. Nothing could harm him. His father was so upset. You're not afraid of me. The demigods, when I just raise my eyebrow, they tremble and they run. And you're not afraid of me at all. You're supposed to be afraid of me. Get afraid of me. You're not afraid of him. No fear. Fearless. One of our devotees who was attending a japa retreat, in the beginning of the japa retreat, we asked people to write down in a little 3x5 card there, sankalpa. Do any one of you three boys know what sankalpa means? Sankalpa? Do you know sankalpa? No?
Without guilt?
Huh?
Without responsibility?
No? No? I'm looking at the children just to keep them, you know, it's Saturday morning and I was looking behind you at Nandasuda. So, sankalpa means intention. You know, why do I pick up my bead bag and chant? What is it that you, what is your intention? What is the goal? It, because behind an activity is it's purpose driven. What do you wish to achieve, to accomplish? So materialists have material sankalpas and devotees have spiritual sankalpas. At least we try to. And it helps, it more than helps. It's necessary to fix the mind. That, you know, sankalpa. Like Hiranyakashipu, when he went to do those austerities, he had a sankalpa. He wanted immortality. Right? That's an example of sankalpa. The Olympic athletes, when they're preparing for the Olympics, what's their sankalpa? Gold medal. So a devotee, or anyway, a yogi or devotee, also, it's just something. Whether you're recognizing it or not, there's some sankalpa operating in life. It's what's helping to shape and direct the mind. Where does it go? It's like your GPS. What's the destination? Put in your destination, then you can get there. You don't put in a destination, good luck. GPS isn't going to help you. So, the yogi is intending to fix his mind on the Supreme Lord. And these are processes by which they can fix the mind on the Supreme Lord. And when they do, it's like, at least progressively, it's like the lamp in a windless place. But this is a different example than in a windless place. It's the lamp that goes out. The material mind stops flickering because the intention, the sankalpa, is the Supreme Lord. And as that intention is strong and sustained, we strive, and more, the happy, natural happiness that's there by fixing the mind upon the Supreme Lord takes place. The material flickerings of the mind subside. The flame, like when the lamp breaks or when the oil is finished, the lamp goes out. It's not the mind becomes zero. You become mindless. Rather, it's a mind that's absorbed in the thought of the Lord. That kind. So, the material mind is dissolved. And the spiritual mind is fully operative. And the material mind, going back, where does the material mind arise from? We have one. Where did it come from? And it comes from the sum total of the material ingredients. It's called pradhan. And when the living entity and time mix with this undifferentiated totality of material energy, our dear friend false ego is the first element that arises. And false ego that mixes with goodness, the mode of goodness, produces the mind. So then there's where our mind comes from. But supposing the mind now fixes on the Supreme Lord, the mind dissolves. The material mind. Living entity is still there. The material living entity has thinking, feeling, willing capacity, but now no longer covered by material modes of nature. Got it? Let's do it again. Fix your mind upon the Supreme Lord. Just chant your japa attentively. The actions of the modes of nature will subside. You can give your, yeah, but just persevere in practice. Abhyasa yoga yoktena chetasa nanya gamino. Persevere in practice to fix your mind with attention, with love, appealing for the kripa shakti of this wonderful Supreme Lord to connect you with Him. To allow your dear mind to go to Him. And if He gives His mercy, then it becomes possible. And then the material thoughts are like the flame that becomes extinguished. The mind is still there. It's conservation of energy. Mind is still there. The modes of nature are still there, but they're just not they're not mixing. They're not interacting. The mind doesn't become disturbed. Prabhupada writes, cessation of the mental functions means cessation of activities conducted under the influence of the three modes of material nature. You know, this is this rasavarjam rasopyasya param drishtvanavartade. It's the higher taste. The higher taste of the mind absorbed in Krishna instead of the mind absorbed in the modes of nature and its all of its different manifestations. It's how to get out of the clutches of illusion. It's not easy. Once we're caught, not easy to get out. Yeah, like a prison. And exactly, you know, tied up with ropes. Well, those ropes are the modes of nature. Not easy to get out. But one can get out if one who's not tied up by ropes releases the ropes. And that's Krishna. And the representatives of Krishna who apply Krishna's instructions can release those ropes. And here's, you know, drilling down on that very beautiful understanding is how it happens. The actions of the modes of nature no longer influence the soul, because the medium of influencing the soul is the mind. So it's essential, not optional, that the mind has to be controlled. It's essential, it's not optional, that you chant with undivided attention. Not optional. You can chant without, you know, inattentively, you can do that. But the happiness and the influence of the spiritual happiness won't be experienced, and therefore, you know, will continue to be distracted. And yeah. Now the verse for this morning. Text 36 and 37. Thus, situated in the highest transcendental stage, the mind ceases from all material reaction and becomes situated in its own glory, transcendental to all material conceptions of happiness and distress. At that time, the yogi realizes the truth of his relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead. He discovers that pleasure and pain, as well as their interactions, which he attributes to his own self, are actually due to the false ego, which is a product of ignorance. I'll read the purport, but because it's very nice and not so long. But the message is, this is the goal to repeat, the message of Kapila Dev's teachings by analysis of matter and spirit, applying the spirit conception to the process of meditation, fixing the mind in meditation upon the Supreme Lord. It's ultimately pure devotional service. Where the modes of nature aren't acting, thoughts of the Supreme Lord, meditating upon his laughter, his smiling face, his eyebrows, his beautiful eyes, all the different features of the super soul. I mean, that's how, why the in Brihat Bhagavatamrita, it describes that one of the upper planetary systems is a planetary system where they do this. So, Bhuloka, that's where we are. Bhuvarloka and Swargaloka. Bhuvar and Swargaloka, the three of the upper seven planetary systems. The Maharloka, Janaloka, and Tapaloka. Just below Lord Brahma's planet is Tapa Loka. Tapa means austerity or penance. Tapa, tapasya. And in Tapa Loka, they're meditation fans. They, when Gopal Kumar went there, he thought they were being rude. They wouldn't even talk to him. They were just like absorbed in meditation for days at a time. And why? Because the Supreme Lord is appearing constantly in these features that are described. And they don't want to stop meditating. But from time to time they stop meditating. And then they have really high-level philosophical discussions. They take a little prasadam and they go back and meditate. Doesn't even say they take rest. They just like, they're really enthusiasts for meditation. And they try to persuade Gopal Kumar, just stay here, why are you looking for Madan Gopal? We see him all the time. Sit down, we'll show you how to do it. But the process of, he doesn't stay there because the process of active service is what he wants. Because that's, this leads to that. So, He wants, that's where he wants to go. That's where he goes. He goes to Goloka, not Tapaloka. Purport. Forgetfulness of one's relationship with the Supreme Personality of Godhead is a product of ignorance. By yoga practice, one can eradicate this ignorance. of thinking oneself independent of the Supreme Lord. One's actual relationship is eternally that of love. The living entity is meant to render transcendental loving service to the Lord. Forgetfulness of that sweet relationship is called ignorance. That in ignorance one is impelled by the three modes of material nature to think of himself as the enjoyer. When the devotee's mind is purified and he understands that his mind has to be dovetailed with the desires of the Supreme Personality of Godhead, he has attained a perfectional, transcendental stage, which is beyond the perception of material distress and happiness, you know, the whole of duality. So the beginning instruction, one of the beginning instructions given by Krishna to Arjuna is to tolerate the duality, happiness and distress, pleasure, pain, honor, dishonor, hot and cold. In this world is a place of duality. Anything you could think of, there's its opposite also. In the realm of absolutes, it's not like that. It's transcendental happiness. Even when there's feelings of separation, it looks like sadness. It's ecstasy. Like we discussed yesterday when Ram was feeling separation from Sita. It's an intensified kind of ecstasy. It's not like, you know, the material kind. Woo, 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 he didn't love me anymore. Woo, woo, sing of the blues. Can't get my mind off of him or her. It's not like that. That's material attachment. It's the perverted reflection of the spiritual reality. So, paragraph. As long as one acts on his own account, he or she is subject to all material perception of so-called happiness and distress. Actually, there is no happiness. Just as there is no happiness in any of the activities of a madman, so in material activities, the mental concoctions of happiness and distress are false. Actually, everything is distress. That's the bad news. Here's the good news. When the mind is dovetailed to act according to the desire of the Supreme Lord, one has attained the transcendental stage. Nice sentence. The desire to lord it over material nature is the cause of ignorance. And when that desire is completely extinguished and the desires are dovetailed with those of the Supreme Lord, one has reached the perfectional stage. Which is just repeating something that was said before. The mind becomes extinguished. The material covering of the mind becomes extinguished when the mind becomes fixed upon the Supreme. So the conservation of energy becomes fixed over here, no longer over there. Desire. What does the Lord's desire make our desire one with the Lord's desire? It's not like we lose our individuality, it's desire and his desire in love, the relationship of love. So one's desire becomes the desire of the beloved becomes the desire of the lover. And that way, there's oneness. Still, individuality is there, but the medium is love. And he quotes, you know, upalabdha paratma kasta. Upalabdha means realization. So one gets to realization that the happiness of Krishna is my happiness. You realize it not theoretically, but you experience that happiness. What's that happiness? Ananda mayo bhyasat, quoted here. That's, you know, the absolute truth is ananda. When your thought is in relation to the happiness of the absolute truth, you experience that ananda. And that's the greatest happiness. When one experiences the greatest happiness, there's no attraction for shadow-like so-called happiness. It's just no attraction for it. No attraction for it. And the last verse, because it has a short purport, I'll cover it also. Because, text 37, because he has achieved his real identity, the perfectly realized soul has no conception of how the material body is moving, or acting just as an intoxicated person cannot understand whether or not he has clothing on his body. Interesting comparison. Purport. This stage of life is explained by Rupa Goswami in his Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu. A person whose mind is completely dovetailed with the desire of the Supreme Personality of Godhead and who engages 100% in the service of the Lord forgets his material bodily demands. Not that material bodily demands stop, he just forgets them. He's still absorbed. No, so the lust and anger and greed, they just fade. Like Raghunath Das Goswami, his hunger. Prabhupada once described he ate so little. You know, a palm full, how big is your palm? You know, have a palm full of buttermilk every other day. Said his body was very skinny. In fact, his body was trembling, he was so skinny. Prabhupada said, but his activity was moved by spiritual energy. So it's a spiritual principle replacing a material principle. It's not, we can't do those things. We would die. We would die. But he wasn't dying because of spiritual energy. So the strength is spiritual strength. So we need to exercise our spiritual muscle to get spiritual strength so we can also overcome, transcend, go beyond the influence of the modes of nature, these lower things. The indications that say, whatever, oh, my honor has been hurt, or something. So I've been neglected, or something. Different, those kinds of feelings. Okay, so we'll end there, see if there's any questions or discussion. Anyone out there? You have the balcony seats back there. If you're comfortable there, it's fine. There's space in here if you want to come in. Yes?
Maharaj, the question is about chanting holy names. And you have spoken a bit about japa. But my question that was coming is, when we're chanting holy name, sometimes I get confused, we're trying to serve the holy name, but sometimes it feels like we're taking service because we may be calling out for help and saying, please help us. And sometimes the help may be something material related. So how do we prevent that feeling of sometimes guilt in saying that we're supposed to be serving the holy name, why am I taking service?
Well, there's three things. One is, like a child, is in fact dependent on their parent. And parents, in fact, are to extend care to their children because their dependents are dependent. So for the dependent to feel dependent is not material. It's natural. Necessities come from the supplier of those necessities. And so, you know, for one, the standard of necessity is different than for another, for standard of necessity. You know, somebody may, of necessity, may need one bowl of khichdi, and somebody else may need two, or one and a half. Because their metabolism is different. So, there's a supplier of those necessities. Krishna is that supplier. So, depending upon my realization of that supplier of necessities, this is now consciousness proportionate to the individual's realization, there's a sense of relationship of the supplier of necessities. The mother, loving mother, knows the capacity of her child or children and what their requirements are, and so she knows whether to give them 1.5 or 2 or 1 bowl of khichdi. She knows what, you know, she observes what their general capacity is. The child doesn't need to ask the mother, you know, can I have a bowl and a half of khichdi? Mother knows. But, you know, they may say that. And the mother's not displeased. Why are you asking for it? You know I'll give it to you. Why are you asking for it? What's wrong with you? The mother isn't going to do that. But Krishna understands our, in short, Krishna understands both our necessities and our devotion for him. So we need not hide from Krishna what our mentality is. We display to Krishna as part of love what our mentality is, what our sense of our relationship is. With such a prayer where we're asking for necessities, or the prayer that may be for our material benefit, it's that's mixed. Better it's mixed than missing. Better than mixed is unmixed. But supposing I'm not there, now what do I do? Pretend that I'm something I'm not, and come to Krishna pretending I'm something I'm not? That's, and you can do that. But Krishna, I have this desire. There's a very nice verse, this among so many nice verses in the Bhagavatam, where it's in the Uddhava Gita section, if I can recall correctly, 11th canto in any case, where the description is there about the devotee that's mixed, and but has knowledge, which sounds a little bit like where your question is coming from. The devotee that's mixed but has knowledge understands the goal is this, I should become to unmixed. They also understand I have some material desire. They also understand that material desire leads to misery. Nonetheless, they come before Krishna with their material desire, feeling regret or repentant that that material desire is there, but nonetheless the material desire is there and they go forward, knowing that the material desire, aspiring for it and getting or don't getting it, it leads to misery. But they go with faith in the ultimate process of approaching Krishna, they go forward. So, I'll see if I can find that exact verse. I'm paraphrasing it, obviously. And then, you know, there's commentary. It seems very appropriate. It's appropriate for all of us, appropriate for your question. How do you deal with those feelings of guilt, was your question. When we go to Krishna and, you know, ask him for something as opposed to offering service to him. And those feelings of guilt that I'm coming before him to ask for something when I should be simply asking for service. It's this, you know, the big question of the gap from what we know and what we know and where we are, and how do you move between where we are to what we know, to the position of unmixed emotional service? How do you handle that? How do you navigate that gap? You know, You address Krishna. I know that you know. I know that you know that I know. You're all knowing. I wish to come to that unmixed stage. I'm not at the unmixed stage. I regret that I'm not at that unmixed stage. I accept that there'll be consequences for being unmixed. It's not your problem. It's mine. I still want to engage in your devotional service. And you go on. And the hope against hope, Asha Bandha, is Krishna is very kind. That's where we repose our hope. Krishna is very kind. He will, recognizing that part of me that wishes to serve him, he'll accept that service, the mood of service, and that will grow. Krishna is very kind. That's our hope. And so the feelings of guilt isn't elevating. We can regret, that's elevating. Dwelling beyond that, it's the mode of ignorance. And then we just got beat up in a dark alley. We got mugged. By Maya. Don't go down that alley. Feel regret and carry on in your devotional service. Calling for Krishna's mercy. Continue chanting, calling for Krishna's mercy, calling for the engagement into service. That's what the Maha Mantra is. Maybe other stuff going on, but you know the spirit, the power of the Maha Mantra is to be engaged in Krishna's eternal loving service. It's a call for that. The potency is there within the mantra, even though we got a different channel going on. Anything else? Yeah?
Hare Krishna. You shared that example of Gopa Kumar going through Tapaloka, meeting with devotees who were meditating on Krishna's features. So in that regard, I was thinking that what if that Gopa Kumar is desiring that he's able to go to Goloka Vrindavan, and would that also be the final destination of those who are doing meditation there?
Don't go to the next one. I want to capture what your first question is. What is it that carried him beyond Tapaloka as opposed to those that stayed in Tapaloka?
Yes.
Okay. Then the next one. And?
And so when we are meditating, when we are chanting on Krishna's holy name, let me translate Krishna's holy name, and then as you are sharing that, Krishna will reveal different features of his holy name. So what is it that we should desire following in footsteps of Gopa Kumar so that our destination is same as?
Okay. Well, if we're Gopa Kumar Vadis, which seemed in a broader sense, what Sanatana Goswami is advising us as sattakas, you abstract that from the whole narration. Two things primarily. One, it's specifically mentioned, Gopa Kumar says at one point, that I could not remain in this place, that place, the other place, because I would not be fulfilling the desire of my spiritual master to give me what he desired to give me. And I couldn't do that. I couldn't be ungrateful. That was the language. I could not be ungrateful to my spiritual master. And that's an elevated sentiment, but because my spiritual master wished to give me something. And I can't loiter here and not receive that which my spiritual master wished to give me. And that impelled me to go on. That was one feature. And the other feature was, again and again, it grew, which is his desire to be in the direct presence serving Madan Gopal. And that was what why he didn't stay in Tapaloka, is it just didn't fulfill that desire. He was seeing the Supreme Lord, but it wasn't the same. Seeing the Supreme Lord in his mind wasn't the same as being in his physical presence and being embraced by him and taking prasad with him and doing those things with him. Bhakti was incomplete just by seeing. Wanted to engage in his spiritual form, in spiritual activities with the Supreme Lord in a loving mood. That's what he wanted to do, not just see him. It was incomplete. And for us, that's why he didn't stay in Tapaloka, and why they in Tapaloka, they were convinced philosophically. They gave philosophical explanations. That sounds like, wow, that was cool. One may be compelled to say, yeah, that's it. One of their arguments for Gopakumar, why are you looking for Madan Gopal? We're seeing him all the time. Then their explanation is, seeing begins in the mind. Before you can see with the senses, you have to see with the mind. So just see with your mind. This is what we're doing. Come on in. It's nice. So he did for a while. But, they were satisfied because that unmixed bhakti was not matured. For Gopakumar, it wasn't matured, but the seed was there. And, the same could be there for us. To not stay at a certain stage of devotional service, but the seed that gets nourished by hearing and chanting sincerely, carefully, attentively, can nourish that seed of literally being in the spiritual presence in our spiritual form with the personality of Godhead, loving and serving him. If he is so kind to have that hankering. And, stages of, second part of your question, stages of bhakti unfold naturally. If we do this stage properly, it leads to that stage. It's like the, taking a seed and germinating the seed, and then, slowly this little boop, this thing comes out of the soil, and like that, two leaves, then four leaves, and just keep nourishing the creeper of bhakti, and that stage will come where, like Gopakumar, this is nice, but we want that loving service with Krishna. And then exclusively, to the exclusion of all other things. Not some other things, all other things. That's high, but that's the mature stage of bhakti. It comes from nurturing the creeper with proper attentiveness and hearing and chanting. Yes?
Maya, actually, the goal of Maya is to take us away from... The goal of Maya is to take us away from Krishna.
The goal of Maya is to take away from Krishna?
Yeah.
Take away what from Krishna?
Take us
away from Krishna.
Maya, in Gita, Krishna says, mind, intelligence and false ego are the manifestations of Maya. So... this intelligence is the discriminative agency of Maya. So to what extent can we rely on intelligence that it is helping us or it is helping Maya? Because mind...
Well, it's real simple. That which takes us to Krishna, that's helpful. So intelligence can take us... We use our intelligence. We have, and we're supposed to use. Like what is Krishna saying? In Bhagavad Gita, about one who worships this sacred conversation, one who studies a sacred conversation is worshipping me with his intelligence. We're supposed to use. Where do we discriminate? That's what intelligence does. Discern this from that. We're using it. So we must use it. It's Bodhi Yoga. We must use it. But that Bodhi is, my own intelligence is more not only deficient, it's distracting from the real goal. Therefore, I need this intelligence that comes from our acharyas. And so it's that sense of dependence, the good sense of dependence upon higher authority and reaching for that higher authority, and that becomes our intelligence. Not the other kind. There's some intelligence that says, my intelligence is insufficient, I need that one. And then we take that one, that's another intelligence. But behind it is, you know, it's so, behind it is the desire of the soul to be in a relationship with Krishna. That's the operative principle. So we do it to a lesser degree than we will do when we become more mature in our devotional service. But intelligence is operative at every level, just like the mind is operative at every level. It's just, how is it operative? Many persons, conditioned-souled persons, are very proud of their intelligence. And often their intelligence, the person next to them is saying, what's wrong with this guy? The goal is not to turn the intelligence to the off position. The goal is to completely purify, come to the spiritual and Bodhi Yogam Tam, the Dami Bodhi Yogam Tam. To have Krishna give us the spiritual intelligence. How to come to Him. So, the test, which is your question, is how we're going to Krishna, or not. Because Maya's feature is take us away from Krishna. So, our understanding of what's taking us to Krishna should be guided by the intelligence of our acharyas. That's the intelligent person. The other one is, you know, I've got my own idea of what takes me to Krishna. Then one becomes a pseudo teacher. Something else? Yes.
I've been thinking about religion. Particularly why there are contradictions between various world religions, particularly the issue that has been focusing on is the worship of idols being forbidden in Christianity and embraced in Krishna consciousness. What do you think about this?
Well, a simple answer is given in Scripture, and that is, due to the modes of nature, there's diversity.
I like that response.
Originally, it's one. Then there's the modes of nature. And then the modes of nature makes many. Time. Also, Bhaktivinoda Thakur writes about how time has a feature of destroying things. So, time presents a view. Excuse me. The Supreme Lord presents a view, and then time spreads it out. Time in the modes of nature.
This strike gives me very few responses.
Now, specific to idol worship, the Vedas also condemn idol worship. Deity worship is not idol worship. Then that's the intelligence making a distinction between what's the difference between idol worship and deity worship? It's very simple. Something is given by God and something isn't. And something that isn't, then I get the material intelligence how to do something that isn't. And I do that. And call it the real thing, but it isn't. Like people make up religions. Not just, you know, they make up all kinds of things. And the fertile factory of the brain, of the, you know, the material mind. They make up something. Now why did they make up something? Because there's original something. They don't like that original something. They want to make up their own. It's independence and the modes of nature and time. Then you get like, then, you know, it gets really complicated. Then, you know, this innocent young man comes along and say, my goodness, look at all this array of stuff. The spiritual marketplace, there's a zillion things out there. How do I discern what's what? It's Kali Yuga. So then you look at one of the features to look for is that which is unbroken. From Bhagavad Gita, that master that's unbroken.
Thank you for your answer. You
may be a little familiar with the practice of the Mormon faith, that they have youth between this age and that age. They, for 2 years, they go and represent the Mormon faith here and there. You familiar with that?
I am.
Okay. So one of the places that there's like a kind of a headquarters where they visit is near our Gitanagari farm. You familiar with the Gitanagari farm? Mid-Pennsylvania?
I've been informed about it.
Okay. Please come sometime. It's really a nice place. It's a mystical, magical place. So, for years, I've been going there and conducting seminars. And the place, the Mormon gentleman, like an elder in the Mormon faith, during the summertime, it just happened to be coincidental with when we were conducting these week-long seminars in Gitanagari. Many, like, you know, 40 or some of those Mormons would come and spend time with this elder, and they would come over to the Gitanagari farm. It's like, you know, he would introduce them. Oh, here's the teacher. He's teaching some stuff. You want to speak with him, go right ahead. So, in the course of the conversation, this is anecdotal, but I said to them, have you ever been to Palmyra? They said, no. Said, well, I, Palmyra is where Joseph Smith went up on a mountain and got teachings from God and came back down and told his people. This is what God said. So when I was, that's in upstate New York, and I said, I've been to, when I was young, we used to go every year to the Mormon pageant in Palmyra. I said, oh, what was it like? Someone would share, you know, so it was just sharing. And then I asked them a question, which was, do you know what those teachings of Joseph Smith were? And do you know that whether the teachings that you're receiving today are the same as the teachings that Joseph Smith received in Palmyra? He said, well, of course they're the same teachings. He goes, well, how do you know? Because don't things get changed over time, generally? They said, well, you know, the elders in Salt Lake, you know, they're overseeing all that. So I said, I suggest, you don't have to do this, but I suggest you make your best effort to find out what the teachings of Joseph Smith were, and then see if the teachings that you're receiving today are the same as the teachings that Joseph Smith gave. I said, I've done that in my tradition. You know, Krishna spoke Bhagavad Gita. And then there are lineages of great teachers that explain what Krishna taught in Bhagavad Gita. Now I've got a current one, but then there's, you know, the line of teachers, and you go and compare. I'm sure the literature is available in the Mormon faith, you know, over the period of time. And it's not so like 5,000 years ago. It's not so long ago. Go study it. See if it's the same teachings. I won't be surprised if some things changed. Because when I was growing up in Christian faith, that's one of the things that turned me off. When I was young, the Ten Commandments read one way, and I graduated from college, and it changed. The Ten Commandments changed. I was shocked. You know, thou shalt not kill became thou shalt not murder. What happened? What's so if that's going to happen just during 10 years of time, what about, you know, 1,000 years of time? And sure enough, little research, a whole bunch of stuff got edited out. Purposefully. So, is what you're reading in the New Testament the teachings of Christ or not?
It would seem to be yes and no.
Well, you know, some of it's there and some of it's distorted and some of it's missing. It's not like, you know, the people are bad. It's just, you know, if you want the real thing, make sure you're getting the real thing. I mean, it's related to your question. So back to, you know, specifically, idol worship. We're not, you know, we, the Hare Krishna movement, or the followers of our Gaudiya Sampradaya, Brahma Madhva Gaudiya Sampradaya, we hold the same position that Christians do. That, you know, idol worship is not good. And there's a distinction between idol worship and deity worship. What's that? Then, okay, if you want to know, here's the explanation.
Thank you.
It can go on, but you get the basic idea. Anything else? Yes.
Seek out a deity, like purchase one in any way.
You
like it has to be given to you.
No,
it's not.
It's okay. Is that okay? If your question was, is it okay, or must you wait till it comes into your home?
Yeah.
You either way is fine.
Then what's the distinction?
Oh, the distinction is, how the worship is to be done. The form, how the form is established, and the process of installation, and the process of worship. You know, it's authorized.
Okay.
Prabhupada's example is a post office box. You can make your own. Paint it even looking the same as a U.S. post office box. And any mail somebody puts in that post office box is going to sit there and rot. Because it's not authorized. But the one that's the U.S. Postal, authorized by the government, box, you put your mail in and it goes to the destination. Somebody comes and picks it up and they sort it and do what they do and goes to the destination because it's an authorized.
And the authorization being the prescribed practices?
Everything. The making, the installation, the worship, the decorating, the mantras, the whole process. Authorized by scripture, by, you know, coming from Krishna, ultimately. And that's deity worship, and the other is something else. Another hand was up? Yes.
Thank you so much. As you were talking about prayers, like we can go to the Lord and pray for our necessity. So I was thinking that is prayer means to ask something, whether we need or something, or prayer means to glorify the Lord?
Narottam Das Thakur has written something that he describes 10 or 11 different types of prayers. So there's two. Glorification and a prayer of request. And the prayer of request doesn't have to be, you know, I want a bigger car. It can be, you know, I want a purer heart. And that's a request. Then there's different other, I can't recall the categories. So different types of prayer. And it's just to clarify, you said that I said something I didn't say. We should act from a position of self-honesty in our relationship with Krishna. We have to know, you know, Krishna will help us understand what we don't understand about ourselves. But we like to understand who we are and then act according to our actual position conditioned, but the, and also mixed with genuine sincerity, and approach Krishna in that way, not in, you know, pretending that we're something we're not, any other direction. And if part of the position is there, you know, so akama sarva kamo va moksha kama udharati, you know the verse? Tivrena bhakti yogena yajeta purusham param. The teaching of Lord Chaitanya is without a requisition slip in your hand. Na dhanam, na janam, na sundarim. Not asking for something that people ask for. That's the advocacy. At the same time, if that desire is there, better you approach the Supreme Lord with that requisition slip than you pretend it isn't there. You could pray, let me become free from these false shelters, thinking there's happiness to be found in something temporary and limited. There isn't. But nonetheless, it's there. So, my dear Lord, I'm embarrassed. But help. So, then the relationship. Yeah.
Maharaj, I just want to clarify, understand. So, we talked about this metaphor, the lamp in the flame in the wind.
Nice example, isn't it?
So then, we said that there is wind, we can't take away the wind. And you said that, so what can you do about it is to have the right sankalpa? Is that what you
mean? Well,
because I'm trying to...
There are three things. You're mixing three things into one thing. One is the metaphor of the lamp in the windless place and the lamp in wind, flickering. Another example is the conservation of energy. It's a different example. Then the third thing is, you know, sankalpa. Those are three things.
So I'm trying to see in a real situation where, you know, we talked about Pratyahara, where we, you know, withdraw senses from the sense objects, not for sense gratification. So, I mean, I've been noticing, like, when the sadhana is very good, the hearing and chanting is good, I don't have to try.
It's automatically there.
It's automatically there.
Fantastic then, realization.
But then Maharaj, like...
But, sometimes it's not, sadhana is not so good, and there's the struggle that goes on.
And that's the win part. Like.
Yes, it is.
I mean, by the time I realize that sadhana is not good, it's already, I mean, it takes a long time. I mean, it's very subtle, slowly it degrades. So,
I'm waiting for the question.
So how to, when I can't take away the wind in the form of, you know, office work or...
You tolerate. That's the beginning, like, you know, kindergarten. You tolerate. If one can't tolerate, then one is, you know, moved by the wind. So, this is Bhagavad Gita. Just knowledge helps with the detachment. Knowledge says in the verse, it's the senses contacting sense objects in the mood of enjoyment that causes the duality. That, you know, the happy, sad, honor, dishonor. Has nothing to do with the self. But because of my desire to enjoy the expectation of happiness, enjoyment in this world of duality, I experience duality. Sometimes this, sometimes that. That's the wind. It's duality. Modes of nature are acting. Sometimes. It's like a cork. Or a little small piece of wood in the waves of the ocean. Sometimes up, sometimes down. Sometimes up, sometimes down. Sometimes up, sometimes down. You get seasick. That's the wind. You know, the changing of the, you know, time in the modes of nature, swirling the material energy around, and you're just bouncing around. So that becomes more prominent when sadhana is weak. What to do? That's the question. Well, different things. Minimally tolerate. Then you can go, it depends on what is it, what are your primary sources of strength. You go there. One of the primary sources of strength in general for a life of devotion is knowledge. It leads to detachment. It's temporary. It's not who I am. It's arising from sense perception. It's arising from the conditioned soul's tendency of trying to be a separate enjoyer from Krishna. And that's the problem. That's the root cause of material existence. And you apply the brake pedal. Knowledge detachment. So, okay, that's the do not. Now what's the do? The do is take a deep breath and let me apply myself according to the discipline that I've learned. It was like this, you know, the ear doctor is saying, you know, what's the training that required to do your profession? It was very direct. And it's boot camp. Discipline, learning, you know, you take shelter of higher character and higher principle as a matter of, this is the way of life that I choose. I'm choosing to become a devotee, a practicing devotee. So let me go there. That's part of the character building and mind and sense control elements. You go there. You tolerate. And then you take shelter of some higher principle. Withdraw and invest. You withdraw consciousness from over here, and what will keep it withdrawn more likely is you invest over here. Instead of meditating on this lower nature thing, let me meditate on the higher nature thing. And the lower nature thing may scream, yeah, you can't leave me alone. Noise. And you just like, I'm sorry, I'm going over here. It's like a child throwing a tantrum. The uncontrolled mind. For so long, you've been uncontrolled for so long, you think you're in charge, but you're not in charge. Krishna's in charge. And I'm going to Krishna. He's my boss. He's my master. And I love him, and I know he's loving, and he's much better master than you are. I'm going over here. And by practice, you ever go for a walk in a forest? Sometimes? And sometimes it appears that there's a path in the forest. And the rest is just forest. How did it get to be a path in the forest, in the middle of the forest? Somebody went up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down and up and down. So many times it became a path in the forest. So, go up and down and up and down. Instead of over there in the jungle, just go over here. And just, by design, I'm going to make a path. The path to Krishna path. I'm just not going over there. I'm going to Krishna. Sorry. Prabhupada, saying the same thing in a different way, beautiful way, Prabhupada said, my dear mind, you've been in charge for so many lifetimes. For this one lifetime, I'm going to be serving Krishna. I have faith in service to Krishna. Will be a much better master than you. I'm going to go here, and that's it. No, that's it. That's a de- sankalpa. That's an intention or a commitment to a relationship. And that relationship, the good news is stronger than you are. So you're not just relying on your own strength to go over here instead of over there. Krishna sees, Krishna will help. Oh, you want me? I want you 100 times more than you want me. You want me, I will help you. And then you feel that support, that loving gesture of Krishna helping you. Wow, that's what I want. I want it many, many, many times more, but just even that is so wonderful. The weakness is not on his side, it's on my side. So I feel encouraged, I keep going. And then this noise is still going on over here, but I just keep going to Krishna, that's all. Okay, it's 10 o'clock. See the Prabhupada key. Yeah.